The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
Good morning and welcome to this June 12th, 2019 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. We're on iTunes under Writers on Writing. You can subscribe to us there. You can find us on Stitcher or however else you prefer to digest your podcasts these days. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. We are doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, about their process, about their craft. I'm here this morning with Deborah Eisenberg, author most recently of Your Duck Is My Duck. Deborah Eisenberg is a MacArthur Foundation Fellow and the recipient of honors including the 2011 Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction, a Whiting Writers Reward, and a Guggenheim. Eisenberg has published five collections of stories, Transactions in a Foreign Currency in 1986, Under the 86 Airborne in 92, All Around Atlantis, Twilight of the Superheroes, and most recently, Your Duck Is My Duck, which came out last year. Her first two short story collections were republished in one volume as The Stories So Far of Deborah Eisenberg. The first four volumes were reprinted in 2010 in The Collected Stories of Deborah Eisenberg. She's a professor of writing at Columbia. Deborah, welcome.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, well, you know, you might know, I've been trying for this for a long time. This has been a long dream of mine. So this is a huge pleasure. And I guess to that point, I was going to say, you know, there are these handful of authors that I'm always dying to talk to, but they're often the writers that I sort of sense might hate talking about writing and about their work. I sense probably right. They enjoy doing the work more than they enjoy talking about doing the work. Am I wrong to sense that about you?
No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right, and I'll bet most of them are dead anyhow.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's such a difficult sort of ethereal thing to give language to, and I don't know, it's just, I just find it, you know, hard to articulate sometimes, and I always wonder if writers feel the same way, but they've got to do these book tours and all of that.
Well, I was thinking about that this morning, actually, maybe anticipating our conversation, but I don't really have to do tours because I write short stories which don't generate any profit for anybody. But I do sometimes, of course, have to talk about writing, my writing. I was thinking this morning that it really can't be done. I mean, one is sort of talking along a parallel track, trying to somehow indicate something that's on the other side of a barrier.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree.
Well, there, I've totally stopped the conversation.
No, that's exactly. Yeah, I mean, that's my sense too, and I. You know, I think when it's done well, if it's not genre writing or something that's very formulaic and, you know, you can kind of talk about the story. But when these stories are, I don't know, they're producing sort of a more emotion than, you know, book club discussion questions. And it's difficult to talk about. So as you look across the arc of your work, across these five collections and across the decades, are there things that you find that still won't let go of you, places that, you know, your kind of tongue keeps returning to in your mouth like a, you know, like a sore? Or as you go through the work, do you find yourself interested in new things and exploring new territory?
Well, I would say possibly more mysterious question is the first one, the preoccupations or even obsessions. And of course, they're not totally unrelated, these two things. The staying at the same places with the same worries or the same things worrying at you on the one hand, and on the other hand, trying new things or being interested in new things. I would say that in a way, the content of my stories or my preoccupations are inextricable from the question of how to go about writing about them, which is a question that is not only unconscious, but also aesthetic. Mm-hmm. How do you approach something? And I would say that I've certainly gotten, or I feel I've gotten, you know, who knows, I'm not in a position really to judge my own writing, but I would say that I've gotten much more adventurous in regard to the way I come at something. That might be a good thing or it might not be, but I seem to require new ways to approach things. As far as what interests me, there are certain things that have always interested me, even when I was a child. The mystery of time, for instance, as it's experienced by human beings, and actually cried on my 10th birthday, and it was that double digit clicking into space, into place. I thought, well, no way out of this now. And I suppose most children are very interested in power because for the most part they don't have any, and they're quite interested in getting it. So I would say I've always been interested in disparities of power, disequilibria of position, and those things come up in my writing over and over and over and over. And as an adult, my awareness of the strange position of a taxpayer in the United States has become more and more central to my everyday experience and the oddness of doing things, having an effect on the planet that I myself am not aware of and don't want to have. So that just keeps bubbling up in the work over and over.
Do you think that question has become more urgent in the last 2 years?
No question about it.
Yeah.
No question about it. Or it's certainly become more urgent as catastrophic climate change increases with this astounding velocity, and it's become more apparent to people as a terrifying worldwide repressive tendencies become more and more to the fore. People are more aware of it.
Right. Do you think, is it harder for you to write in this? I mean, the world seems to have gotten noisier in the last years. And, you know, I think that has a tendency for a lot of writers to silence them or to think maybe my energies are best spent elsewhere, or I'm so much in the middle of this that it's hard to make sense of it while we're living through it. What's your experience of writing in a lot of noise?
That's interesting that you found it to be prevalent. I also find it very, very, very difficult. And when I say I think I've gotten more adventurous aesthetically, I think it's a way of, I mean, I have to find ways to sort things out, to fit these new strange shapes into my brain in some useful way. I have not written in surely a year and a half. That's not terribly unusual for me. I go through long periods of silence while I do whatever it is that's done. That work that is private that you yourself don't know about. But yes, it's terribly, terribly difficult. Partly, I think, because the enormity of what we're witnessing is so shattering, so shocking. And I remember reading in a book that I absolutely loved, which it's a bit of an oddity. It's a sort of memoir by somebody who took the name of Sebastian Hoffner to write it. And he was a young German who was on course to be a fancy lawyer and left Germany. He was not Jewish. He did have a Jewish girlfriend, not a serious girlfriend, but he was dating a Jewish girl. And he left Germany, I'm not sure what year it was. It was in the 30s. And he went to England, and he wrote this manuscript to bring to England to try to convince people, the English, to get into the war. But by the time he had finished it, the English were in the war. And one of the things, I'm going through this lengthy description to say that one of the things, as I remember, that he mentions in this book is the absolute triviality of the fiction that was being written as the Third Reich became more and more powerful. And, you know, it was all about cats or, you know, romances or very, very slight. And I always thought, oh, yes, that's, it was because of a tremendous callousness. I mean, I was always focusing, I think, on the people who wrote badly or in a trivial way. But now I see that people who really could write probably and wanted to probably had no idea how to go about writing fiction at that moment.
It's interesting because I know that your grandparents were immigrants and Hungarian descent, Russian descent?
No, definitely the wrong side of the tracks. My father's parents, I believe, were both from Eastern Poland or whatever it happened to be called at that particular moment. Maybe it was Ukraine, maybe it was Poland, maybe it was Western Russia. Mm-hmm. You know, the borders were just whipping around like crazy. My mother's father was from Belarus, and my mother's mother was from Russia.
And at some point you had talked about kind of all this rage that you experienced as a child and pontificating on maybe some of that was generational trauma that, you know, you didn't yourself experience, but sort of inherited trauma. And now that we're living through this point in history, I wonder if you feel like kind of two halves of your life are in conversation with each other. Does that make sense? Like,
oh, yes, it does. That's such an interesting thought. Yes, I think that's absolutely true. And, you know, I remember some years ago, people, well, the usual thing that people say about women with leftist tendencies, you know, oh, you're hysterical, shrill, et cetera, et cetera. Well, people aren't really saying that any longer, except real ideological opponents. But I think everybody is in a terrific state of alarm. I mean, not everybody, obviously, but many, many people are. And it's affecting people in, I mean, a kind of fear, whether it's identified as a financial fear or a political fear or a social fear. It's affecting people strongly and in different ways. People are angry. People are frustrated. People are frightened. People are irritable. And I think that I was maybe responding early to early indications, loudly and almost bodily, almost physically, a kind of anxious alertness to danger that probably came with a history that I myself didn't know about, but was transmitted to me.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. That's interesting. So you've always
lived... It's a guess.
I'm sorry?
I said it's a guess.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. No, it's a... Yeah. So you've always lived in New York as an adult, yes?
Yes. Yes.
Do you feel like... Have you ever considered living anywhere else? Because I'm always wondering about the feel of a place and that particular place and living through kind of what that city has lived through over the last little bit. If you feel like the city somehow influences your work, or if your work would be, you know, the same in Tulsa, Oklahoma or something, you know, if your desk is your desk and your mind is your mind, or if the city itself somehow plays a role in your thinking.
Oh, I think very much so. And it's partly just having a lot of people around and a fairly diverse context in the city, just day to day as you're walking around. Although I would say the racial inequities are pretty apparent here, but yes, I would say with I don't feel my desk is my desk and my mind is my mind. Of course, I have considered living other places. New York is extremely expensive, for one thing, and for another thing, of course, it changes a tremendous amount. Partly because it is big, it changes a lot, and it changes fast in a way that maybe smaller places don't. Some kind of centrifugal stability or something. But where on earth would I live? The whole world is pretty much one place now. It's just a big corporate fiefdom, and I do feel that I need English. I feel I need my language around.
Yeah, yeah. Do you feel, maybe I should have asked this before when we were talking about the sort of traumas that we're living through, but I was wondering about your feeling of responsibility of artists, if you feel some sort of burden outside of the already tremendous burden of just trying to put words down on a page, which I think is tremendous, but some sort of responsibility that writers have, that artists have, that that you sort of, you know, feel the obligation to reflect what we're going through in society in a way that's kind of bigger than the work itself.
I think probably the stance that I generally feel in regard to that is an unpopular one, which is that I don't feel that writers, any kind of artists, have any responsibility in particular. And I think that really, in a way, the responsibility is towards a kind of anarchic freedom mentally, I mean, and that if you place upon yourself that burden of the kind of social responsibility, you're likely to paradoxically blind yourself to your actual experience of the world, which is all you can offer. It's all you can offer, that and your skill and your craft, which I really don't take that idea very seriously in regard to fiction writing. But if you were a painter, for example, it would be a serious matter. But I don't know what I believe. I don't really understand any of this. But my feeling is that what each of us has to offer as a fiction writer is the unique mind that every human being has and the unique way of seeing, and that really our responsibility is, if we have any, is to just try to portray that with some kind of fidelity, which, as you say, is really, really difficult.
Yeah. Actually, yeah, I mean, I think if we do put that responsibility on ourselves, it's already, if you set out to write fiction with an agenda and, and some idea to change somebody's mind, it's just terrible. I mean, I guess you should write an essay then, but yeah.
Yeah.
Good point. So you said, you just said that if you were a painter, it would be a more serious matter than if you were a fiction writer. Can you kind of unpack that a little bit for me?
Oh, I just meant that the craft would be. I think if you're painting, there are ways that you really want to know how to use the brush, how to use paint, how to make a composition, and that sort of thing. With writing fiction, I never know what people are talking about when they say craft. And I mean, craft is, in my view, knowing the language, being able to use the language. That's pretty much the only requirement. Everything else you're on your own about. Painting has a lot to do with its own history. Poetry has a lot to do with its own history. All kinds of writing have a lot to do with clarity of one sort or another. But that's about as far as it goes, in my view.
Yeah. You teach, though. How does that go? Do you enjoy teaching? And kind of how do you approach it?
I really don't know. It's pretty, as to how I approach it, that's the question I'm responding to now. That is, if we're speaking about teaching a writing workshop, that's very ad hoc for me. It's just, what does this particular writer want to do in this particular piece? Well, the only person who actually can answer that question is the writer herself or himself, and that's a process of discovery. So I can try to help with that. Do I like it? Not really. What I really love is meeting the students. I've met so many interesting, even thrilling people over the years, really interesting, and many really gifted writers. And it's my only way of meeting younger people. I don't have children. Well, it's my best way. But so I absolutely love the people that I meet. I love the way of meeting them. But the intimacy required in, say, a fiction writing workshop, I find not only exciting and gratifying, but also kind of upsetting and creepy.
I like that word.
Yeah, I mean,
I guess it kind of requires you to crawl around in somebody's psyche and, with a probe and a dictionary.
Right, exactly. And of course, the subject of the probe has to participate and give over. So, you know, it's a contract between two people that requires, I would say, very good faith on both sides and a real unguardedness. And it's, I would say, it can be taxing and exhausting for everybody involved, as well as profoundly gratifying.
Yeah, yeah. So if I understand your sort of approach at all to writing, to the extent you'd even say you have an approach, it's not one of, you know, I have this idea I want to explore, or I have this character that interests me, or, you know, this compelling setting, whatever. It sounds more like this sort of mystical experience, like less like letting your mind control the process and more of kind of a surrender to your subconscious, of just kind of sitting down and being quiet and seeing where it goes, as opposed to controlling it with your own mind. Is that sort of accurate?
I would say it's exact. It's exact. I mean, of course, then at a later stage, the control comes in. And the control is always there in regard to the specific sentence or word or paragraph. I mean, always, always, always you have to... I have to subject, I mean, everybody works differently. I have to subject the writing to the question of, and it's obviously not an articulated question, but the question of, is this really what I mean? Is it really what I mean? And that goes on in successive stages of precision, of course, with different drafts and different revisions and so on. But yes, I mean, I am, the requirement is just to let the thing express itself. It's too horrifying to let things come into your mind. Thank goodness there's paper that you can drain things onto.
Right. It's almost like easier to express things, not as you're saying, you have to get down to the accuracy of each sentence. It's in your work, it feels much more more accessible to do that by analogy and by some other experience other than the direct experience itself. Like you have to come to the experience sort of sideways, you know, sidle up to it like a, you know, like a snake from the side, as opposed to hitting it dead on. And when you can use analogy or metaphor or simile, all of those things make the reader feel something, as opposed to, and experience something as opposed to, I don't know, living through some factual series of narrative events, that makes any sense.
It makes plenty of sense. And I would say it's true in different ways. I mean, for one thing, it really isn't. It isn't very effective to say, my dog died and I felt very sad. I mean, that just doesn't, well, the I felt very sad doesn't go very far. And the my dog died reminds people of how completely horrible it is when their beloved pet dies. And then they're often running in their own mind, not on your piece of paper. So neither fork of that formulation. Well, I didn't put that very well, but you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. Neither one works very well. And also, my wonderful sweetheart or consort, whatever you would call him, who is a fabulous writer and fabulous reader, once said, and I've quoted him on this because I think it's so great, he said, your stories aren't what they're about. Aren't about what they're about. And that's true, that that's there's true. A kind of narrative armature, but it's really a way of translating some otherwise inarticulable emotional or mental experience.
In this way, I'm wild for the filmmaker Charlie Kaufman. And in this way, your work on paper and in the short story form reminds me of what his movies are able to do. And I would say the same thing about him, that his movies are not about what they're really about.
And, oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, that you experience them, but you can't tell somebody about them. You know, it would defy description, right? If you set out to tell somebody about them, they'd think you were crazy and they'd never go see it. But
Right. And I think if you try to describe one of my stories, if you say, oh, it's about a man who blah, 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 that's extremely boring, whatever it would be. But I hope that the reading experience is a lot more interesting than the experience of hearing the narrative described.
Correct. My guest this morning is Deborah Eisenberg. We're just talking about life. I was going to say the book we're talking about, the most recent book, is Your Duck is My Duck, but we're really just talking generally about life here. You have said that when you really don't know kind of what a story is about until the very end of it, when you look back and try and, I mean, not the last draft, but you know, when you have finished it, if it's going to work or not. And I was wondering about abandoning projects and if you do that, if you get, you know, 6 months into a project and determine that it's not going to work and kind of how you make that determination, if it tells you or if you tell it that you're done with each other.
Well, you know, when I first started writing, that never happened. I could always wiggle something into itself. And things never end up where they started out anyhow. So it's a little hard to tell whether you're actually abandoning something or it's just twisting into what it meant to be in the first place. But in recent years, I've had things suddenly flop up on deck absolutely dead. And there's no question. They're dead. They can't be resuscitated. They're just inert. And so, yes, I've abandoned some things.
I was going to mention before, when we were talking about kind of Charlie Kaufman and your approach to this, that a lot of it almost feels like, I mean, it doesn't feel like poetry in the form of poetry, but the emotional tenor of it being, you know, the narrative is way less important than the emotion, does seem very poetic in your work. And I don't know what role kind of poetry play. I assume you don't write it, but I don't know what role it plays in your thinking. But do you kind of have that in your mind, that you're trying to create more emotion than linear experience in your reader?
No. Okay. I don't really have anything in my mind. I really don't know, but I suppose I don't find then this happened, then that happened very interesting. I'm just trying to find what I find interesting. And I've never written poetry. I wouldn't dare. I find it simply astounding that anybody can do it. But strangely, it tends to be more poets than fiction writers who like my work, I think.
Yeah, right. I can see that. You said something that was really useful to me, because I'm always struggling with resistance. I think every writer or artist or anybody living on the planet struggles with resistance. And, I always kind of wonder why that is. And you articulated it as a feeling of shame that when you sit down, you just can't believe how bad your work is. I mean, not you personally, but, you know, once one sits down and reads what one has written, it's very shameful. And, I mean, you're just kind of aghast at what lives inside of yourself or something. So, can you talk about kind of overcoming that or pushing through it? Or, I mean, at some point you have to gain an amount of confidence, but I don't know how, besides through time and task, one comes to do that. But I don't know if you have any thoughts on shame and overcoming it, or at least putting it in the corner for a little while.
Yes, I think I would agree that the main route to overcoming it is simply acquiring a kind of confidence, and that really does take quite a lot of time. And you never really think, oh, I'm going to disappear breeze, or I know how to do this. But I think it helps a lot to learn what a difference you can make by tiny, tiny, tiny revisions, that you can look at something you wrote the day before. Let's say it's paragraph, and that the paragraph is absolutely mortifying. I mean, you thought it was great the day before, then you went to sleep, you wake up, you look at it, it's just terrible. But if you actually just steel up your nerves and don't have high expectations, and you just spend the day on the paragraph, and you make a few little changes. You change a word, you mess around with the order of the sentence, you insert or detract some punctuation, you realize that something is unclear, you make it a little clearer, something is awkward, you make it a little less awkward. Well, the tiny, tiny, tiny changes can make a huge improvement. And if you do that enough times with that paragraph, you will end up with a very good paragraph, or you might. And if you do that enough times with a piece of fiction, it is going to be a lot better than you thought it could be. And you're going to discover a lot of things. And if you've done that even once with a whole piece of fiction, you don't know that you're going to be able to do it again. But you have that feeling incorporated into yourself that you have done it and that it can be done. And that's always with you. If you even made one sentence better, you've done it. That can't be taken away from you. And to me, that's how people acquire confidence.
I always think it's sort of interestingly paradoxical that when you sit down, the first thing out of your mouth or your pen is all the cliches and crap. And then through the time and task, as you describe it, of working through it and playing around with punctuation, it becomes truer. I mean, you would almost think that the first instinct when you sit down is the truth, the real emotional truth, because it has urgency and something caused you to sit down to write it in the first place. But it's really through all of that revision and toil and task that the truth really comes through. And that always struck me as sort of a psychological paradox, that the more time spent, the more the real urgency comes through correctly, I guess.
It seems to be a paradox, but I don't think it really is, because as you say, the first thing, the urgency, that feeling of needing to put something down is absolutely divorced from the words that are available to you in which to do it. And of course, the first resources at hand are always a cliche, always.
Mm-hmm. True. True.
Unfortunately,
yes. Yeah. Is there something outside of your writing life that serves or feeds your writing life? Because I know you're deeply involved in the world of theater with your partner, Wallace, Sean, and I assume music kind of plays some role in your life. But are there things outside of sitting down at your desk that you find feeds you when you're at your desk?
You know, I have no idea. I have no idea what goes into what. I've done something awful to my foot. I don't know what it is. If anybody knows a good podiatrist, I'd love to know. But I really like walking around when the weather is pleasant. I really like it. I really like going to movies. I like seeing friends, although there seems to be less and less time to do that. But what goes into, I mean, as you said when we started to talk, the world is very, very noisy now. And I find that I want more and more time. I require more and more time alone. And there's no way to get all this noise of the world out of one's head. And mysteriously, also, as you were saying, one feels that one should not. One should really be attentive to what is going on. And yet it's flat. It's annihilating. So there's just the balance of listening and reading, listening to and reading news and paying attention to the world, and also hiding under the bed and curling into a ball. I don't think that addresses your question, but there we are. That's where I ended up.
No, that's right. That's right. There's this great observation that I think it was in Recalculating, the last story in your collection, just about when you're young and the field. I'm totally misquoting this, but the idea was that when you're young, you have just these vast field, you know, time is like this big giant open field. And then as you get older, it just constricts down into you know, this very narrow line of a path. And I take your point about needing more time alone, sort of to the, it's funny, with all the people that we say we want to spend time with, we do not. And time seems suddenly more limited and more precious than it seemed like when you were, you know, 15 or something. But
or even 50.
Yeah.
To those of us who are past that.
Yeah.
Yes.
You, it's funny because when I hear you talk, you seem very, age seems like a gift, and for your characters, not so much. You know, some of your characters seem very, a little bit more melancholy or a little bit more reflective. And, you know, I guess all of those things must be true, But it seems, at least as a writer, that age and experience are more gifts than burden.
It's a very, very complicated thing, age. Yeah, I would say, sure, they are gifts, but they are gifts. And I find one of the strange things about being old, and I felt it more and more on the way to that, is how intense it is. It's like being a teenager. Everything is so intense. And that's great, but it's, you know, it's partly the intensity of fear. And I've always been, just by temperament, melancholy. There's no way out for me. You know, the sort of shafts of blinding shafts of happiness are even more intense at my age. I mean, this spring has been just so gorgeous. I don't know, are you in New York?
I wish. No, we're in Southern California.
Well, I have to, I'm sorry to say, it's been a very beautiful spring here in my view, sort of protracted and everything in sustained bloom. And it's so beautiful. I just feel that I'm going to faint practically every second. And it means more to me, partly because, you know, our expiration date isn't stamped on us. We don't know how long we've got. But it's very complicated. Every possible feeling is interwoven. Fear, joy, bitterness, a kind of freshness. Everything is interwoven.
That's so great. That's beautiful. I hate to bring up smoking because I imagine this might feel now like ancient history or such distant past, but it was a topic that came up quite frequently some years ago that you used to talk about, and your observation then that you couldn't be a writer. You wouldn't have come to writing if you hadn't given up smoking. I think that's just so interesting that those two things sort of were battling each other out in you, or I don't know. Tell me about that, because I think a lot of writers or artists or just people in general, people walking around, battle with something that is sort of their Achilles heel, that if they can't shed, it's just holding them back from something. And I thought your observations on that were so lovely.
Well, thank you. I mean, I had no thought of writing when I was smoking, but, you know, I was smoking a lot. I was smoking 3 packs of Gold Watch a day. That's a lot of nicotine. And it is a very potent drug. And I would say, a very miserable and frightened person. And I was simply anesthetizing myself. And I would say when I didn't have that anesthetic any longer, I mean, I did totally explode. I totally fell apart. I was in just pieces all over the, you know, it was horrible. I was in little shards all over the room for about a year and a half. But I was so desperate I would have done anything. And going back to the matter of shame, I think shame was certainly one of the things that would have prevented me from trying to write anything. I mean, I knew I couldn't. I never would have tried to write. It never occurred to me that I would be able to do it. And, you know, then, but I was just holding myself together with these globs of nicotine. And then I just didn't have anything to lose. So at a certain point in your life, shame can be conquered by desperation, I guess. Hmm.
And so you would say that the writing came, it didn't replace all of that, but it became something that could grow in place of it because that was gone?
I guess that's right. I mean, it wasn't really my idea, again, to refer to my wonderful sweetheart. It was, he said, here, okay, you know, here's your notebook, here's your pen, it's time. And somebody quoted something to me, which I think she said it was from Lord Chesterfield's letters to his son, but I looked at that, and I couldn't find it. I didn't find it a fabulous book. It was mostly about deportment and propriety or something. But the quote she recalled was, if a thing is worth doing, it's worth doing badly. And I took that to heart. I really did. And I think of it a lot. You know, I had always thought, and I've heard other people say this in exactly the same words, if I'm not as good as Dostoevsky, why try? Why should I bother? You know, the world has Dostoevsky. Well, I had always thought that, and it never occurred to me to try it. But then, you know, after all, you might as well really try hard to do something that you don't think you can do. It's really the working and the trying is what generates the strength, the insight, the energy. It's not about being able to emit something that is perfect. It's about doing something. It's active.
I love that. That's beautiful. Oh, it kills me. We're drawing down on our time. Are there things we should have talked about that we didn't talk about? We talked about a lot. But
we talked about a lot of things. Yes, I can't think of anything. We really talked to each other.
We really did. We really did. That was wonderful.
It was wonderful to talk to you, and thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. This was a long, long treat coming, so I really, really appreciate this.
And I really appreciate it, too. And I hope we'll actually meet as humans one of these days.
I would love that. I would love that. That was Deborah Eisenberg. The book, Your Duck is My Duck, is out and available now. That's all the time we have for today. Stay tuned for more great programming coming up next, Arts and Beats, on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back here with you next week. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great, great day.